It's time for Fed Talk, the live show for Feds in the know. From federal agencies to Capitol Hill, the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth bring in experts from across the federal community to bring you inside the issues. Fed Talk is meant to provide general information about legal issues. However, the views expressed in this program are not intended to provide legal counseling. Listeners are cautioned not to rely upon any statements made in resolving legal issues they may face, but instead to consult with their own attorney about specific situations. Attorneys are not engaged in providing legal services while appearing on the program and are not responsible in any manner for the consequences that may stem directly or indirectly from reliance on any statement made during this program.
Good morning and welcome to Fed Talk. I'm Jenny Mattingly, and this week we have a really great show. We've got some guests in here to talk about reforming congressional ethics process. A lot of times we focus on executive branch, but we're doing a little bit of a focus on legislative branch today. And I've got some folks with me in the studio. I'm joined today by Craig Holman from Public Citizens Congress Watch, Jim Thurber from American University, Aaron Sherb from Common Cause, and on the phone we've got Meredith McGahey from Campaign Legal Center. Welcome, and thank you for being here today.
Thanks. Good morning. Glad to be here.
Great. And just a quick reminder for our listeners that Fed Talk is brought to you by GEICO, where 15 minutes could save you 15% on car insurance. For more information, go to geico.com. And as I mentioned, as we just started the show, we're talking a little bit about Congress and some of the ethics issues, or also the regulatory or lack thereof structure in place on these ethics issues. And you all have been working on this issue for a while, and we've had some things in the news this week, especially with a public citizen report that you've done. But I wanted to at least introduce our listeners to each of you and hope that you could give me just a quick brief background on where you're from and how long you've been working on these issues. Craig?
Yeah, I'm Craig Holman. I'm the government affairs lobbyist for Public Citizen. I'm a lobbyist who lobbies for lobby reform.
And something you hear every day.
As a result, I'm one of the very few lobbyists on Capitol Hill who will actually call himself a lobbyist. It's even on my business card.
As a lobbyist myself, it's not a dirty word.
I'm proud of my work.
So great. Well, thank you for joining us. And Jim, thank you for being here.
Sure. It's good to be here. I teach a course on ethics and lobbying, have for 15 years, and teach a course on how to lobby in an ethical way for the last 30 years. I write about it. I'm the director of the Center for Congress and the Presidency at American University, and I've been involved with these issues for many years on the Hill also, where I was a staff member.
And there's a lot of issues that keep coming up and coming back that we're going to focus on today. So thank you for being here.
Right.
So, and Aaron, go ahead and give us a little bit of your background.
Sure. Thanks, Jenny. So I'm the director of legislative affairs at Common Cause. And like Craig, I am a lobbyist, but my title does not indicate so. But I do not think it's a dirty word by any means.
It's good.
So I've been working on kind of pro-democracy reform issues for about 5 years. And before that, worked as a congressional staff member for about 4 years before that. So it's, like Jim, it's interesting to see what it's like on both sides of the table.
That's right, because you get a little bit of different perspective coming from every direction. So, and Meredith, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. I've been working on these issues since 1987 and have been working to be a good advocate for good democracy during that time in several different iterations. I'm currently the policy director of the Campaign Legal Center. I worked on the Hill for 6 years, and I'm originally from New Mexico and West Texas and went to college out in California. So it's been great to have a chance to work with a very diverse group of people on these ethics issues. And I've been really impressed at how kind of groups across the political spectrum have come together on this set of issues involving ethics.
And I think that's a good point. People are coming from a lot of different backgrounds on this ethics issue. And I know you all as a group have been working together on towards a common goal on reforming the congressional ethics process. You know, and one of the things I hear that you've been working on some of these for many, many years, clearly the work's not done. You know, we've made some strides, but there's a lot of work to be done in terms of reforming ethics, from your opinions at least, and wondering if you could give us a little bit of a background on where we stand currently with ethics. Some of this has changed over the last few years, but I know that we've got a little bit of a movement in terms of the Office of Congressional Ethics for the House. But could you explain for our listeners how Congress is I get what the oversight is, how they are held accountable for ethics issues. And Jim, I don't know if you'd like to start us off with a little background.
Sure, I'll do that. others certainly know a great deal about it also. Mm-hmm. I study it more than write it, you know, proposals pushing for reform, as others have. We've had a reform in 1995 for lobbying and ethics. We have some ethics changes, minor ones, every year as in the House of Representatives when they pass new rules because they have to have, every 2 years, they have to pass the rules. They're not continuing like in the Senate. 2007, we had a major reaction to Abramoff, to Bob Nye, to Duke Cunningham, who eventually was convicted of bribery, but was not investigated by the House of Representatives, by the way, during that period, and many other things, proximity of votes to campaign contributions and earmarks, lots of things that I think create a situation where the American public has really lost trust in the institution. The institution, in terms of evaluations, lately it's been 12 to 15% of the American people think it's doing a good or excellent job. I haven't met any of those people anywhere.
Well, but, and I was going to say 12 to 15, maybe higher than I've heard.
Right. Well, it's dropped. It's dropped below that. It's usually in the 30 percentile in the old days when people really trusted it. But back to the point, there were major reforms that went through. Many of us, I was one, was very concerned about enforcement. The Senate voted on having a Senate Office of Integrity, similar to the House of Representatives, OCE. It only got 30 votes, and Obama and McCain and others pushed that. They really aren't doing very much in the Senate in terms of a transparent way of investigating problems. The House of Representatives is much better because of the Office of Congressional Ethics, but I think there are problems because lately it's been very difficult to investigate situations where members lawyer up and then they shut up. And it's very different than the executive branch. And I'm concerned about that. And I think others are also.
Well, and one of the things, Craig, I was going to say is that it's really them policing themselves. Aside from OCE, at least if you look back before, there was nothing in place, really.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I'd like to enhance on some of the background. Prior to our reaction to the Jack Abramoff scandal in 2007, there were some ethics rules on the books, but no one was enforcing them. So you had Jack Abramoff, for instance, doing unlimited wining and dining for members of Congress. He had his own restaurant, Signature's Restaurant, and table 46 was set aside for members of Congress to come there every evening and get free gourmet dinners, unlimited wine. And this was one of his tools of influence peddling, along with things like providing free travel to Scotland to go play golf, gifts, sporting tickets to events. And no one was looking at this and enforcing this. So in 2007, when Jack Abramoff finally became a national sensation, epitomizing the corruption here on Capitol Hill, we helped draft the Honest Leadership and Open Government Act that implemented a series of new congressional rules, banning wining and dining, restricting any privately sponsored travel, banning gifts from lobbyists or even people who employ lobbyists. So we implemented all these new rules. Then we had one more thing to deal with, and that is having enforcement of the rules. And so at the same time, we were pushing the Office of Congressional Ethics or an independent agency that would supplement the role of the House and Senate Ethics Committees. These ethics committees, I'll say this briefly, are members themselves overseeing their colleagues, and they operate in secrecy. So as a result, these ethics committees really viewed their role primarily as protecting members of Congress as opposed to enforcing the ethics laws. So we knew we had to get an outside agency to implement these laws.
Well, and that's interesting because it's, as any person, I guess, human nature, it's hard to police yourself and hard to, go on that way, especially if it's your colleagues and uncomfortable. And, again, sometimes I wonder about, you shine the light too far, and what else do you uncover on that, which is why outside groups are doing this. And Meredith, I know you've worked on this for a while as well. And OCE, it seems helpful to the House, but there isn't the same thing in the Senate.
Well, I think we've all been very impressed by the record that has been established by the Office of Congressional Ethics, and I think that is largely attributed to the leadership of David Skaggs, a former Democratic member of Congress, and Porter Goss, a former Republican member. And I think they deserve a lot of credit because everything the OCE has done of any import, the referrals that they have made have practically all been by unanimous bipartisan votes with the referrals. And in Washington, you can probably count on less than one hand how many times that's happened in recent years. In the Senate, however, we have the same old, where you have an ethics committee, an allegation or a complaint goes in. And after that, it's a black hole. There's no required timetable. Sometimes they resolve these things with private letters. No one sees what that private letter is. And then we are all assured that everything's working hunky-dory and just take our word for it. And I think the record has shown that it's pretty hard to believe that everything is hunky-dory when you see the kind of activities that are going on. They like to kind of give the impression that these ethics issues are simply a House problem. And I think knowing human nature, that's just not the case. And I would like to stress that, you know, the reason we think these ethics rules are so important is not that members of Congress are especially venal or, you know, are some kind of class of criminals or anything like that. It's exactly because they are like the rest of us. They have feelings of reciprocity when someone does something nice. They want to do something back that is nice because that is human nature. The difference is the position of political power and public trust they are in. And so that's why they have to have a very clear and well-enforced rules. And right now, we just don't quite have that process in the House with the OCE because they don't have subpoena power. And in the Senate, we have a system that is basically kind of trust with no ability to verify, if you will, a la Ronald Reagan.
Well, and I think the idea of public trust is an important one, and we're going to have to stop here for our first break. But when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about that because many of our listeners are federal employees who occupy positions of public trust, and so they are also under ethics rules. And so I'd like to explain a little bit of the difference between the two as well. We're going to take our first break here. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around the mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is GEICO anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that GEICO isn't a word, it's an acronym, and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how GEICO actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, GEICO saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like GEICO. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is, GEICO.
To get a free rate quote, go to geico.com, then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact GEICO today to request your special federal savings.
Welcome back to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We just left a few minutes ago and we were discussing congressional ethics process, and we had talked a little bit about the background of what's in place for congressional ethics. We've talked a little bit about differences between Senate and House, but one of the things that's important to our listeners, who many of them themselves are federal employees and occupy an office of public trust, as we were just talking about, they're under some very strict ethics rules. And, you know, they've got ethics reporting, there's a little bit more very strict oversight in terms of Office of Government Ethics, internal ethics offices and agencies. And that's different from Congress. You know, Congress is not under the same laws as a lot of the other federal employees. And you could argue they are pseudo-federal employees themselves. They're under, they get FERS, they get the same pension and some of the same pay and whatnot. So wondering if you could tell me a little bit about the differences between what we're seeing in terms of revolving doors, in terms of how they're oversight, how they're held accountable. And Aaron, I don't know if you'd like to kick us off with some of that and what you've been working on in Common Cause.
Sure, absolutely. So I think just generally having Congress police itself is like having a pitcher call his own balls and strikes, and it just doesn't work.
Or it does for them.
Right, it does for them, but for the public at large, there's a lot of questioning and a lot of wondering how could that be. We'd never allow that for any other institution, but we allow Congress to essentially do that. And that's why Common Cause and all of our groups have worked to help create and want to strengthen the Office of Congressional Ethics and try to create an equivalent body for in the Senate. So I think there are slightly different rules for federal government employees than members of Congress and congressional staff. And Craig is much more familiar about this than I am. But just for example, there are some enforcement issues as well. There are some rules in place for members of Congress and congressional staff. For example, when one is serving in office and is in the process of looking for other jobs, they're supposed to disclose that. So that's widely known. So people know that this person is negotiating for another job. For example, Eric Cantor, former Majority Leader Eric Cantor, it was unclear exactly what job negotiations he was in after he lost his primary campaign in Virginia.
And went straight into the private sector.
Exactly.
Shortly thereafter, yeah.
And so the public deserves to know that, and I think not knowing that help further erodes public trust in Congress and in individual members.
And talking about the executive branch does have much stricter ethics rules. First of all, the conflict of interest statute applies to executive branch employees and not to members of Congress in a strict sense. So, for instance, you'll see that any presidential appointee must divest him or herself of any stock that poses a conflict of interest. And you'll see the Senate Armed Services Committee, for instance, ensuring that the appointment of director of the Department of Defense divests himself of all stock dealing with, military companies. And then those same members of the Senate go and buy that stock up. They're not subject to that conflict of interest code. And even a stronger ethics rule came from President Obama the very first day he stepped into the White House. He passed an executive order that imposed all kinds of gift restrictions as well as revolving door restrictions for the very first time ever in American history. That executive order imposed what I call a reverse revolving door restriction. So when anyone who gets appointed to a presidential appointment has to recuse him or herself from taking any official actions that can significantly affect their former employers over the last 2 years. We've never had that kind of conflict of interest code applied to the executive branch, but it now does. So much stricter ethics rules in the executive branch.
And that applied not only to the political appointees at a very high level, but also members of commissions and committees that sit and make judgments and give policy direction. And the revolving door in is absolutely new. The revolving door out just reinforced what the existing rules were. Although in the Clinton administration, 60 days just before he ended, he dropped that revolving door out regulation, and a lot of people went out and got jobs related to what they were doing in the executive branch.
Right, and that's, and I think we've seen that over the years. They had rules, but I do think there's certainly been a lot of talk about transparency and about understanding where people are going and what they're using their offices of public trust for.
My concern is, I mean, this executive order has worked exceedingly well during the Obama administration. If you take a look at all previous administrations, they've been racked with conflict of interest scandals. There isn't one for the Obama administration. I mean, there are other problems with the Obama administration, but there's not a conflict of interest scandal that has emerged. My concern is, I know this executive order, this ethics executive order, is so burdensome on many appointees and on lobbyists that the next administration, no matter who it is going to get rid of this executive order. So I would like, and I'm going to try, to codify this executive order so we don't lose it once Obama leaves office.
Well, and do you think those are the things that I look at and say, my gosh, it's fairly blatant if you're trying to then get rid of an executive order once something strict about conflict of interest and revolving doors has been put into place. You don't think there'll be some of that public pressure to say, what are you doing? It looks pretty bad if you repeal this executive order.
Well, you know, I think the public is not watching this very carefully, and that's why this group of people have come forward with this reform and other reforms to try to keep this before the public. Only 15% of the American public are watching the election now carefully, let alone watching very detailed problems. I think I've been here for many years, and there's always a scandal. And so I think that they'll start looking at it when there's a scandal, and there will be a scandal, and there'll be these ideas ready to go to deal with it.
Well, and that's really a good point. You need a catalyst. And I end up talking about this in a lot of reform proposals is people don't do reform. It's hard, it's tough, it's a long slog until there's a scandal.
Especially against themselves. You know, the iron law of mm-hmm. reciprocity means that they're not going to do something against somebody else that's a friend of theirs from the ethics committees, but they don't want to do it generally to themselves and make it difficult. Also.
Right. And we saw that about 2 years ago with the Stock Act, when members of Congress had to, based off of 60 Minutes interview, and it sort of culminated and became kind of a pseudo scandal and public thing of members of Congress then having to report on some of these financial disclosures.
You know, they were getting political intelligence.
Well, and that hasn't been dealt with yet either.
Hearings, it's coming up.
From hearings and then having insider trading on that. I mean, it's scandalous.
Mm-hmm. You know, this Stock Act was amazing. I mean, before the 60 Minutes expose, which was an excellent expose, before that, all I could get was 9 co-sponsors on the Stock Act. Mm-hmm. That was it. Then the 60 Minutes expose came out, and the next day we had 280 co-sponsors on the bill.
Well, and that's my point. You put it onto the media, you make it a big thing, and all of a sudden, there's your catalyst. And so, and again, work not done on some of that with this political intelligence piece. And
that's coming up. Well, we've got a legislation drafted dealing with political mm-hmm. intelligence. Just to fill in the listeners, even though the Stock Act made it clear that insider trading laws apply to members of Congress, which it never did prior to the Stock Act, which is breathtaking. But we also had another provision in the Stock Act that would impose the same sort of standards on this little boutique industry called political intelligence, where it's Wall Street operatives who roam the halls of Congress to try to get inside information and then sell it. And they actually make a huge profit on this. We estimate the market runs roughly about $100 million a year, but wow, we don't know who these people are. So the political intelligence legislation that's going to be introduced, has been introduced in the House already mm-hmm. by Representative Slaughter and will be introduced in the Senate by Grassley, would require these political intelligence operatives to register as lobbyists, essentially, and disclose their activities.
And basically the same lobby disclosure that, you know, those of us in this room are subject to as well.
Yes, related to that and to members and senior staff, there's a rule that you have to take 2 years off before you become a federal registered lobbyist out of the Senate and 1 year out of the House of Representatives. There's a major scandal out there going on every day where members leave and they become the non-lobbyist lobbyists. They give strategic advice. They have all kinds of other names for what they're doing, but they're actually lobbying and they're not registering. And the very senior people out of the Senate, I won't name names at this point, are doing this, and I think that has to stop. They really didn't stop the revolving door. They found a new way around it, and I think that's scandalous also.
And we've actually, our coalition or subset of our coalition has worked on drafting legislation, which largely Craig and Public Citizen have put together, and we're going around to try to find bill sponsors in the House and the Senate to introduce this, to close that very loophole that Jim mentioned.
By the way, the revolving door problem that became the genesis of the Obama Ethics Executive Order was originally part of the Honest Leadership and Open Government Act in 2007. When we were working on that, I was working with then-Senator Obama, as well as mm-hmm. Senator Feingold, to impose very tough revolving door restrictions on members of Congress. Well, they revolted. Congress was going to kill the entire ethics law if we kept that provision in there. As a result, we had to drop the provision, so there's very little revolving door restrictions applying to members of Congress. But Obama sincerely believed in it, which is why when he stepped into the White House, he imposed those restrictions on the executive branch.
Yeah,
and he campaigned on it also. I published something on that.
I recall that.
And so did McCain,
I would just like to add here, and I think it's a really important part of this, that, you know, the coalition that put together this these ideas for ethics reform in Congress is a coalition that spans the ideological spectrum. We have groups like Judicial Watch, the National Taxpayers Union are involved in this, and this is because we realize that these issues are not a Republican issue or a Democratic issue. This is about the quality of leadership that you have, particularly in Washington and particularly in Congress. And I think it's really important that your listeners and others, as they think through this issue, think through it in a way that serves the institution and public confidence in that institution, as opposed to any party looking, you know, for a political advantage. As we all know, politicians being politicians, they will always try and find some way to make hay out of some issue, and that's understandable. But I think one of the things that's notable, for example, about OCE is they have been able, which is pretty amazing, to set aside partisanship and make their recommendations unanimous. So as we think through this, you know, I'm out there with my colleagues. We go out with what we call our Diogenes lamp, trying to find members from either side of the aisle that are willing to take on these very difficult issues that don't make you very popular within the body and among your colleagues, but are which are critical in terms of a democratic system working and having the American people believe that the people that are in office are not just there to line their own pockets. We all know that American skepticism and cynicism kind of comes with the territory, but when it really turns to apathy or that, you know, my vote doesn't matter, then we're all in big trouble.
Well, and I think that's a great point, that this is not about pointing fingers. It's not about singling out some individual. You know, it's about good government, and it's about making government work for the people and those who are funding it with their own taxpayer dollars. And so I like that point of making sure that that's in mind and that it's bipartisan. We're going to stop here for our mid-show break, but we will continue on this discussion when we come back. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
GEICO's famous for saving people money on car insurance. And now, if you're a federal employee, you could be saving even more. In fact, you may already qualify for a special federal discount from GEICO. If you're a federal employee, or if you belong to an association like BIG, FEW, FLIOA, Young Government Leaders, and many others, you could be saving hundreds of dollars. Contact GEICO today to get a quote and be sure to request your special federal savings. GEICO got its start back in 1936, specifically to serve federal employees. Today, we're still making it easy for federal employees to save money on car insurance. If you're a federal employee, you may qualify for a special federal employee discount. Or if you belong to an association like BIG, FEW, Young Government Leaders, and many others, you may also qualify. See how much you could be saving. Contact GEICO today to get a quote, and be sure to request your special federal savings.
If you're a federal law enforcement officer, then you know to do your job, you tap inside sources. To have a voice on policy and legislation, you join FLIOA. And when you want federal law enforcement officer news and up-to-date federal court decisions, you read FedAgent.com. If you aren't reading FedAgent.com, subscribe today. It's free. Don't let this source pass you by. I'm John Adler, president of the Federal Law Enforcement Officers Association, and I approve this message.
Welcome back. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And we've been talking about congressional ethics, and we've talked broadly about where things stand, why we're doing this, and the fact that you guys have a really diverse coalition as well that's been working on reform. And recently, Public Citizen came out with a report. Craig, actually, you were the author behind the report, so I'd like to talk about that. That really sort of makes the case for reform a little bit, or takes it a step further and talks about some of the numbers of what we're seeing, that the 2007 reforms, did I get my date right?
Yes.
2007 reforms weren't the end.
Yeah, if I can summarize some of the key findings of the report. The report is the case for an independent ethics agency. As we discussed earlier, the ethics committees in both the House and the Senate are staffed by members themselves, overseeing themselves, and their work is done in secret. As a result, very little happens. In the House, for instance, from 1997 through 2005, what we dubbed the decade of inaction, the House Ethics Committee issued only 5 disciplinary actions in that entire decade. During the Jack Abramoff scandal, which we've all been discussing, 2006 to 2008, where 20 people were convicted of federal crimes and many served prison sentences, the House Ethics Committee came out with only another 5 disciplinary actions in that whole period.
It's eye-opening.
Then we created the Office of Congressional Ethics. And just to define what this is, it's an outside entity that cannot be staffed by members of Congress or by lobbyists. And it does an investigative research on ethics complaints and then makes a referral to the House Ethics Committee, and its report becomes public after a period of time. Well, that transparency has fundamentally changed the House ethics process in that very brief period from 2009 through 2014, what I call the OCE period. We've seen 20 disciplinary actions come out of the House Ethics Committee. So it literally is working at a far greater pace than it ever did before.
It's a drastic uptick in numbers.
Drastic uptick. And compare it to the Senate. The Senate ethics process, which did not accept a similar outside agency, it continues to operate in secrecy. Since May 2012, there were some 26 complaints, or more than 26 complaints, filed with them, and they dismissed every single complaint. And this isn't a new trend. If you take a look all the way back to when we have records from 2007 through 2013, there have been a total of 513 complaints filed with the Senate Ethics Committee,
wow.
And it has dismissed all but 4 of those complaints. So we're seeing a very, very broken ethics process going on in the Senate.
And where are these complaints coming from? Are these people within the institution? Can they be outside complaints? Are they...
Well, in the Senate, they can be outside, but many of them come from members of Congress themselves sometimes. Sometimes they're election-oriented. Other times they come from the press. So they come from multiple sources. The House Ethics Committee, by the way, why we focus heavily on getting an OCE in the House ethics process is the House Ethics Committee came up with a detente agreement among Republicans and Democrats in Congress that only... They will, first of all, only accept complaints from members of Congress, not from the public. And then both parties agreed that they will not file any complaints against each other. And so we had to do something in the House. The Senate is just still broken.
That's really interesting.
So to put a
interesting look at it.
Anecdote on this, I worked for Senator Stevenson in 1976-77. He was chair of the Senate Select Committee on Ethics at that point, and we had lots of confidential conversations. I'm not going to reveal them, but I'm comfortable saying that he felt this was the absolute worst assignment that he had in the Senate, and he did it because he wanted to be on a couple of other committees. I know that now, and he stated that publicly. Nothing happened when he was chair of that committee in terms of any censorship or anything else, and that's reinforced by your numbers.
And just to make another point, there are plenty of members of Congress who would love to get rid of the House's Office of Congressional Ethics, but it's largely been a lot of public pressure on the House leadership to keep this independent ethics body. There was, like Meredith had mentioned, there's a broad kind of diverse ideological groups who support the institution, and a number of Tea Party groups from Ohio actually wrote letters to Speaker Boehner. To make sure that he continues the Office of Congressional Ethics into the previous Congress. And so hopefully that'll be able to do
that again. But it has not become an issue in the campaign. We'd like to see it an issue in the campaign. But
doubtful.
Yeah, right.
I'm guessing it won't.
It's so obscure.
Until there's a scandal, we said before. It's off people's radar. And
we always have hope.
Well, you got to keep that when you're doing this for years on end. So, and Meredith, you had talked a little bit about the coalition, and I know that each of the groups here today have sent a letter up to the House and Senate asking for a couple steps. And I don't think it necessarily is quite as far as maybe some of the recommendations, Craig, in your report, because you had a few others, I think, on top of that letter. But Meredith, can you talk to us a little bit about what some of those requests for reform were?
Yes. In the House, the steps that we believe need to be taken are fairly clear. First and foremost, there is a need for the Office of Congressional Ethics to have subpoena power. This was actually an idea that we pushed. I know when I testified back when they were considering this, was one of the key elements we felt was it's necessary for the office to be effective. I would give them credit for having done a pretty good job without it, but even now we're hearing from them that it is without subpoena power, they're having a difficult time as people lawyer up and don't want to cooperate with the office. So that is something that can be done pretty easily and quickly, even when the office is set up again for the next Congress. I would note that since we have sent letters to the House leadership, we don't have totally firm commitments, but we have gotten both Speaker Boehner and Minority Leader Pelosi to indicate that they don't see any reason why the office would not be reappointed. And I would note that Ms. Pelosi even went further than that. So we want to make sure the office continues. We want to get it to be more permanent so we don't have to kind of live on the edge of the cliff every 2 years about whether it's going to exist, and we want it to have subpoena power. The other part, obviously, is we'd always like a little bit more transparency in the House Ethics Committee. The original idea here was that the OCE would do the investigations and then the Ethics Committee would do the adjudication. They didn't quite get it set up that way. It just wasn't enough support. But obviously, just trying to take a couple of these steps will be an improvement. Over on the Senate side, while we do wish that there would be a similar Office of Senate Ethics, we realize that that's not going to happen in the short term, even though we're going to continue to push for it. But what we would hope over there is that when there would be more transparency, that there would be some timelines set in place for the Senate. One of the things I would note that came up from some of our talks over in the Senate is that many of these new kind of amorphous-sounding groups are seeking to provide privately financed travel for senators. And while some of the groups have taken the position, Campaign Legal Center among them, that privately financed travel for members of Congress should be banned, as long as it does exist, we want to make sure that it is only from permitted sources. And we're finding that these groups come in, the committee staff try and figure out who these groups are and have no clue. And this is part of the problem that we see in the process, and in our letters have asked the Senate leadership to make some changes in the Senate ethics process to make it more transparent, to set timelines, and to empower the Ethics Committee to be able to find out whether or not these groups that want to come in and pay for travel in fact meet the requirements set under Senate rules. I was very happy that we were able to work together as a pretty diverse group in getting this done and getting these recommendations done. But, you know, this is just part of the first part of this effort. And we understand that we're going to have to work pretty hard and push pretty hard to try and get the senators in particular to take this up.
Well, and I'm always a fan of broad coalitions, because if you get people from all sides, all spectrums, all different issue areas together, it makes more of a splash. It makes more of an impact in terms of...
It does,
of,
and I would note, you know, we've kind of they mentioned some of the other groups that are involved, but we also know that many of the folks in the Tea Party movement are very strong on this, and, you know, they see crony capitalism going on in Washington, and you know, that's why I think it's really an opportunity here where you can get folks from across the political spectrum to come together and come you know, agree on some of the changes that need to be made. Now, we obviously won't always agree, and there are issues where we divide, but I think on this it's a pretty strong group of folks that understand what the problem is here in Washington.
However, it is not like a vote on Ebola, where you really did have bipartisanship and almost everybody supported further funding of, in that crisis. It's, yes, we have a broad coalition, but we don't have a broad coalition of the elite on Capitol Hill that are highly polarized with very few people in the middle. And that's the real struggle here, to get people from one party and the other party to sign on. If you get one party, sometimes it scares the other party, and it's tribal, and it's a real problem.
Right. And there's a lot of, you know, trying to score political points and posturing on this issue as well.
And I think voters are really hungry for reform. They distrust Congress and they want to see, they want to hear solutions. They're eager to hear what members of Congress are going to do to kind of fix the system. And so it's, especially during campaign season now, it's talking about ethics issues and how to reform Washington is a very salient point. So Common Cause, we're trying to get Common Cause supporters to going around to rallies or town hall meetings to ask members of Congress and congressional candidates about what they will do if elected or reelected to try to fix the
right
system.
And on this issue, a lot of times the two parties change. We don't really have Republicans versus Democrats. We have incumbents versus the outsiders.
Yes.
Right, and that's sort of the interesting thing. And then you see that a little bit on campaign season as well, who's willing to talk about reform, who isn't. So we're going to stop real quick and take the last break of our show. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about differences between executive branch, legislative branch, and prospects for reform, sort of which are the first steps going forward. And you are listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around the mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is Geico anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that GEICO isn't a word, it's an acronym, and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how GEICO actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, GEICO saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like GEICO. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is. GEICO.
To get a free rate quote, go to geico.com, then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact GEICO today to request your special federal savings.
Welcome back to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We're entering the last segment of our show. We've been talking about ethics for Congress and members of Congress, both, you know, in some respects, it's current and former as they revolve in and out of office. And, you know, for our listeners, we've talked already a little bit about how the executive branch has far different ethics restrictions on it. And one of my colleagues was telling me a story about a federal employee who was saying, you know, I can't even look at a baseball cap if we're at a game without getting an ethics opinion on it. I can't invite my boss to my wedding without getting an ethics opinion on it. I can't, you know, there's a whole different set of rules in place, if you want to call it that. And even, you know, even if a federal employee leaves office, if it's sort of a criminal complaint that they're under, they're still under scrutiny for that. And you don't get the same thing in terms of Congress. And so I like the idea of having subpoena power, having greater ability to look into these issues and take them up for Congress. But as you said, it's baby steps. It's not, you know, it's polarized. We're in a campaign season. Makes it very difficult to get anything done. Have we even started with basics of funding the office, or does that come into play? Is that an easier step just to make sure it's funded someplace else?
Funding is about $1.5 million a year. Of course, it has to be funded every 2 years. They have to go forward with a proposal. The first step is to have it continue and then go to the funding. And in my opinion, it's not enough funding at this point. The members of the OCE do it pro bono. Their travel is, David Skaggs' travel is paid for from Colorado here, but he's doing it out of public service, and I think that would be good if that changed.
By the way, this highlights one of the problems about the Office of Congressional Ethics. Every 2 years, we're in a crisis of trying to hang on to OCE because it was not passed by statute. It was passed as a rules change. Well, every new Congress has to reapprove those rules. And we know the House, most of the members of the House really don't like OCE because they hold them to a higher standard. And so every 2 years, we are worried that the House is going to suddenly defund OCE. So it's a battle that we have to do all the time. Fortunately, we've got Speaker Boehner and Nancy Pelosi standing behind OCE. As long as they're in the leadership, OCE is going to stay in place. But and if we lose them, we're going to be worried again.
Compare that to the executive branch. They have an Office of Governmental Ethics. They have offices of ethics in every department. They have full funding for that. It hasn't been cut back. They have investigations. The IG, Inspector Generals, investigate this also. There's oversight from the Congressman Issa and the House of Representatives on these things. So there's lots of focus on the executive branch. I don't think there are that many problems in the executive branch as a result of that.
Well, it's interesting because my point to some folks has always been when I've talked about this, to the extent that you found people doing things wrong, it's because the system ferreted them out to some extent. And you're always, it's human nature. You're always going to have somebody trying to game the system, do something wrong. It's having the mechanisms in place to find them and hold them accountable and making those mechanisms work. One of the things that some of our listeners and one of the issues I've worked on and recently has been this call, you know, that from some in Congress where certain high profile federal employee scandals, the person has resigned or retired and they still get to keep their pension or get to, you know, get to go off into the sunset, so to speak. And it had me thinking earlier this week about how many members of Congress have themselves resigned under ethics investigations. And, you know, they also have a pension similar to federal employees. They get, you know, similar salary and ethics investigations stop when they walk out the door, as far as I can understand that happens. And so at least to the extent where having a timeline, having people held accountable while they're doing things, that seems to be a very strong first step into getting towards that accountability.
And there's at least one member of Congress who's retiring this year who is being investigated for certain conflict of interest, for certain stock that he owned in a company and was trying to potentially advance the interests of those of that company. And he's since he is retiring, then there's the investigation is essentially will be halted. And so that's one issue that we have to try to address.
I would like to just note that one of the reasons that these ethics issues and ethics enforcement is so critical is that you hear many people these days complain about the criminalization of politics, you know, and that it's really led to all these terrible consequences. Well, one of the reasons that you kind of have this concern is that when you don't have effective ethics enforcement, then, you know, people turn to the criminal system. Certainly there are instances where there has been criminal behavior, but with really robust ethics enforcement, two things happen. One is that you kind of get out of this criminalization issue, and the second is the message gets sent wide and clear to all the senators, the members of Congress, and their staff about what the expected norms are. You would, you know, up there, you would be amazed at how everybody kind of looks around at their colleagues to find out, you know, what's acceptable behavior. And they see someone get away with it, and they say, oh, I guess I can do that too. If you really start setting clear expectations, somebody crosses the line, they really get slapped effectively, then it's going to send a message to everyone else about what the standards of behavior are. And I think that's kind of where we've lost it a little bit, is that we have too many muddy waters, too many muddy lines, and effective ethics enforcement really would start to help change that norm and make that expectation very different.
Now, there's a difference between ethics enforcement and enforcement of the law. Duke Cunningham took bribes. And he was convicted, went to jail. And Tom DeLay was convicted, but it was overturned. It was criminalization of this, but I think it was appropriate because they were breaking the law and they should go forward with prosecution. But the thing, as an outsider, that surprised me was that there was never an investigation of these by the ethics committees in the House of Representatives just to send a message to everybody else that, you know, this is wrong and this is what we found. On Duke Cunningham, it was the press that found out about it by looking at the size of the money that he got for his house And I want to talk about the media. Media is very important in all of this. I think collectively they have done a great job, in my opinion, looking at people doing unethical or illegal things, and yet many times it's not pursued on the Hill. It's pursued through the press.
Right, and that's a great, it's almost akin to, for the executive branch, you've got Congress watching over them. Here you've got the media as well for members of Congress, because there isn't another body there to do that.
And the executive branch, as we discussed already, has stricter ethics rules. You know, it brings to mind the story of the Stock Act, where we applied the laws against insider trading to members of Congress. Well, you know, once 60 Minutes and the public forced Congress into accepting that, Congress said, okay, we'll do this, but if we have to do it, we're going to apply the same law to the executive branch. The law already applied to the executive
Absolutely.
Branch, but they included the executive branch in the mm-hmm. Stock Act anyway, saying what's good for the goose is good for the gander.
Yeah, well, and that's why I, as somebody who's a big supporter of federal employees, I say, well, bring it back the other way, you know? I mean, because we've got the rules in the executive branch, but not on the other side.
And I think just... We knew about this Duke Cunningham case because of the media, and the media was able to get access to information, and that's just why disclosure is so important. And the House does a somewhat better job than the Senate for making documents and records accessible online. The Senate is stuck in the 19th century. So many of the documents are in paper form only, and this goes from not only campaign finance reports, which the Senate still files in paper form,
yep.
But all sorts of other official records with the Secretary of the Senate that people have to physically go try to find.
By the way, the story of Tom DeLay brings to mind an interesting anecdotal evidence of why we need an independent ethics office. Tom DeLay was a close friend with Jack Abramoff. He was involved in all kinds of different scandals and corruption cases. And the House Ethics Committee actually, on its own, came out with a minor letter of reprimand saying, Tom, be careful. Don't do that kind of activity again. Tom got so angry that he had the Republican members of the House Ethics Committee fired.
Really?
And he took them all off the Ethics Committee and you know, just got the – then reappointed new people to the Ethics Committee who were friends of Tom DeLay. I mean, that just shows why we need to have an outside agency and transparency so the public sees what's going on here.
Absolutely, and it's important. I mean, again, these are people with – there's a lot of money, a lot of power, and a lot of major decisions being made. And so – you know, I'm a big supporter of government in general, and I know you all are too, in making it work correctly. And so I'm glad to see this effort out there. We've only got about a minute left of our show, but are you working on expanding the coalition? Do you think you're going to continue to make this push as a coalition going, you know, is this a long-term initiative?
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that we want to do, in addition to trying to build support up on the Hill and find leaders in both parties up on the Hill, is also to reach out to other groups from across the political spectrum and say, come join us. Any individuals that are interested, any other groups that are interested, because we see this as an issue that really very few these days in America, which really crosses across party
and
lines.
That's where
they have to be prepared for the long slog.
Absolutely, and that's where a coalition is good. So we are coming to the end of our show, and I think we could talk a lot more about this and would like to do so in the future. So thank you to everybody for listening and for coming in here today. And it's all the time we have. Fed Talk's brought to you by the Federal Employment Law Firm of Shaw, Bransford & Roth. Have a great weekend.